Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand.
We want a stronger voice in the way the universities run so that we can have a fairer pay for all faculty and that we can maximize the effectiveness of the university.
Coming up, we'll hear from one of the participants of a historic faculty strike at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
I see this as being a case wholly fabricated out of suspicionless surveillance. You know, and it's very topical in this country right now.
And we'll hear in-depth critical perspectives of the recent NATO 3 court case from one of the court journalists reporting on the case. All that and more coming up. But first, here are some headlines from the Indy Media Network in Chicago and around the world. Argentina Indy Media featured a protest against the ascendance of a controversial choice to head Argentina's armed forces. Cesar Milani, who has been linked to crimes against humanity in the previous Argentine dictatorship, has been approved by a 36-30 vote in the Argentine Senate to the top tier of Argentina's three armed forces and the head of the Joint Chiefs. Quoting from a translation of the feature, quote, "A number of human rights agencies and leaders expressed their repudiation of the choice. The Association of Detainees and the Disappeared in a statement said that the 39 senators who approved the rise of Cesar Milani through their participation in the genocide committed during the dictatorship are complicit in the cover-up and impunity." Indy Bay featured a story about the eviction of a decades-old community arts and residential space in the East Bay of Northern California. Quoting from the feature dated December 19, 2013, "On December 9th, which was one of the coldest days of the season, the eviction of the Albany Bulb began. Workers from the City of Albany's Department of Public Works used a backhoe to dismantle homes located in the autonomous wild space where people have lived and created art for decades. Bulb residents' belongings were thrown in dump trucks behind the lines of Albany police. Community members attempted to defend the Bulb by blocking work crews from destroying homes and possessions, and a variety of legal representatives were present, encouraging residents not to sign any papers without an attorney present. Despite clear evidence to the contrary, authorities claimed the camps were, quote, empty, and that they had residents' permission to proceed," end quote. Boston Indy Media featured a victory by a Massachusetts nurses union who won a new contract and called off a strike at the last moment. Quoting from the feature dated February 9, 2014, quote, "The registered nurses of Bay State Franklin Medical Center, or BFMC, have reached a tentative agreement on a new 5-year contract, averting a 1-day strike that was planned for Monday, February 10, 2014. The pact provides protections the nurses had sought to prevent the use of mandatory overtime as an alternative to providing safe staffing at the hospital. It also includes improvements to the nurses' health insurance benefits and will grant the nurses pay raises. A statement by the union recognized, quote, "all the support the nurses received from the communities throughout Franklin County in reaching this hard-fought victory that stretched over more than 2 years and 44 negotiating sessions," end quote. L.A. Indy Media featured a protest demanding justice for a homeless man who was beaten to death by police. Kelly Thomas, a homeless man who was diagnosed with schizophrenia, was accused by police of vandalizing cars and was beaten to death by two police officers. On January 18, 2014, some 150 protesters gathered at the Fullerton Police Department to affect future investigation of Thomas's death. Protesters also drew their ire on a camera crew from a local CBS affiliate, which was covering the protest and taking pictures of anarchist graffiti near the protesters. The protesters responded to the CBS crew by saying, quote, "you're just here to make us look uncivilized," end quote. One woman was arrested on suspicion of assault with 10 protest participants in all who were arrested on charges of vandalism and, quote, "failing to disperse," end quote. Chicago Indy Media posted a feature headlined, "The Chicago Tribune's War on Dissent, Activists Respond." Quoting from the feature dated February 12, 2014, on February 10th, the Chicago Tribune published a lengthy editorial embracing police spying, entrapment, and law enforcement tactics grounded in violence and provocation. A jury had found three defendants innocent of bogus state terrorism charges in the NATO 3 case, a case which was wholly initiated, incited, and put into motion by two undercover police officers whose bosses admitted they colluded with federal authorities to create the case. Dozens of respected activists and groups came together to rebut the Tribune's endorsement of state-sponsored spying, entrapment, and the use of undercover police agent provocateurs to wage war on dissent, a response that the Tribune has refused to publish. The response, reposted on Chicago Indy Media's website, noted that, quote, protesters had to battle for months for the right to protest, including against Mayor Rahm Emanuel's infamous sit-down-and-shut-up ordinance, and hundreds of protesters were kettled and assaulted by police on May 20, 2012, end quote. We'll have more about the NATO 3 case later on in this episode of From the Trenches. Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indy Media website at chicago.indymedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
We are asking one another as we pass the time of day, why working men resort to arms to get their proper pay, and why our labor unions should not be recognized, whilst the actions of a syndicate must not be criticized. Now the troubles down at Homestead were brought about this way, when a grasping corporation had the audacity to say, you must all renounce your union and forswear your liberty, and we will give you a chance to live and die in slavery. Now the man that fights for honor, none can blame him. May luck attend wherever he may roam, and no son of his will ever live to shame him, whilst liberty and honor rule our home.
Faculty at the University of Illinois Chicago staged a two-day walkout and strike on the week of February 16, 2014, marking one of the few faculty strikes at a major research university in recent memory. To learn more about the strike, why faculty opted to strike, and the larger issues at play, we'll listen to an interview with Leonard Davis, who spoke with Chicago Indy Media's Mitchell Stepinchuk. The following interview was recorded just before the strike on Saturday, February 15th, 2014.
We are joined on the phone with Leonard Davis. Leonard is a professor of English at the University of Illinois at Chicago and is joining us on the phone. Leonard, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I understand that as we are recording this on Saturday, February 15th, you are about to embark on a strike. Can you elaborate on why you're going on strike, please?
Sure. We formed a faculty union at UIC about a year and a half ago. We were officially designated as a faculty union. And we've been negotiating for a year and a half with the administration of the University of Illinois. And we're negotiating for a number of things, but particularly we're concerned about we're actually two unions merged. One of our unions is for non-tenure track and the other is for tenure track. And many of our colleagues and members are teaching in the non-tenure track role, where they're getting an average of about $30,000. Some of them are getting $30,000 for teaching quite a few courses, and after having had 6 or 7 years of higher education, having a PhD, they're ending up getting paid what an exploited member of for example, the fast food industry gets. So the point of it is not that all workers should be exploited, but rather that we feel that in our case we can argue for a better salary, for better working conditions, for a voice in the university's governance. And so we've been negotiating that at the table, and we have been getting no or very little the progress from the administration. So we feel at this point that they've ended up forcing us to go on strike, and that's what we're doing.
Can you elaborate on some of the reasons why the administration is giving you the cold shoulder? Is there any reason why? Have they said so?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One of which is that, we're asking for, historically, faculty were the university. I mean, faculty and students are the university. And the administration was a tiny little, a bump on the back of the faculty. It's over the years, and with the corporatization of the American university, the administration has become management, essentially. And what we're saying to management is, look, we're the faculty. The magic that happens on campus happens in the classroom between the student and the teacher. Students have no idea who the administration is. You guys are responsible for making sure we have classrooms and making sure the university runs. But the way it's evolved over time is that they've taken over crucial decisions that have to do with professors, students, and the way the university is being run, priorities. So what we're saying is we want a stronger voice in the way the university is run, so that we can have a fairer pay for all faculty, and that we can maximize the effectiveness of the university. The administration, obviously now seeing itself as management, doesn't want to give power to the workers. They want to be able to control all the decisions, which is essentially what they do. I mean, we haven't had a raise in 5 years, and if they decide they're going to give us a raise, they make an arbitrary decision. And we just have to sort of be happy with it or not. We have a faculty senate, has no power. It's called shared governance. And the shared governance of the faculty senate is essentially that we discuss, we say we made a decision, and they say, okay, thanks. We'll take it into consideration. I mean, I've said that, shared governance in the faculty senate is like saying that, you're the dog in your house when your dog whines and you decide to give it food is part of the decision-making structure of the house. So, I mean, that's sort of where we are in terms of one thing, which is faculty voice. And the university does not want to give in on that. On the compensation issue, it's kind of mysterious because the University of Illinois at Chicago has a gigantic reserve. I mean, by our latest calculations, and this is public record, they have something like $1.2 billion in hand. They are claiming that a lot of that is restricted, although a professor wrote recently to the provost and said, look, if you really have an economic issue here, show us the books. And, we'll look at the books and it'll be obvious that you can't give us raises. But the reality is that they're claiming part of that's unrestricted, although they're not showing us why it's restricted. They just have general terms. And then there is $275 million each year, approximately, that's unrestricted funds. What we're asking for is essentially make up for the 5 years of no raise, make up for all the people who worked at UIC for a long period of time and had no cost of living adjustments. And our numbers say that it would cost them $7 million the first year and half of that the second year. This is out of $275 million of unrestricted funds. And this goes back to the issue about faculty governance. What kind of decision-making is going on in the university administration and management that is like someone is deciding, look, we're not going to give faculty salaries, but we are going to build this building. We are going to and the other thing which is really crucial is that in the last 5 years, the administration has added 90 new administrative jobs. That is, they've sat around at the table, they scratched their heads, and they said, should we hire someone to do more work for us? And the answer is, yeah, sure, why not? And there's no one to tell them no. Whereas at the same time, they've decreased the number of tenure-track positions by 14. They were eliminated. So they're basically bloating their own selves, and they're starving the faculty, which means you're starving the students. So, I mean, if this was, your parent who was, like, sitting there eating at the table with, huge amounts of roast chicken and pork, and you were on the other end of the table eating a cracker, that's kind of the situation that we have right now. The other end of the table are the students and faculty, and the hoarders and the bloated administration is on the other end. And by the way, I mean, if you look at the salaries of President Easter, for example, it's, you know, close to $500,000 a year, while we have faculty members who are making $30,000 a year. And not only that, but like Easter and the chancellor and all of these people get these crazy bonuses where if they just stay on the job for 3 years, they get another $500,000. So this money is being, and this is taxpayer money. Taxpayer money. They were taxpayers are paying this money thinking that it's going to their children who are going to go to university. So it's kind of outrageous.
Sometimes I found in experiences I've known of regarding organizing efforts among faculty, sometimes graduate student faculty and others, is that there sometimes emerge divisions among, like for example, tenured faculty versus non-tenured faculty versus graduate students. And sometimes they may organize, but maybe organize separately, but not necessarily become cohesive. In your opinion, do you think that there's been a lot of cohesion among the various faculty, tenured, non, and even graduate students in this effort?
Yeah, that's actually been one of the beautiful things about going through this experience. First of all, I should point out that the graduate students have a union. They have a contract. The teaching assistants have a union. They have a contract. So the group that hasn't had a contract is the faculty, tenured and non-tenured track. So inherently you would imagine that there is a tension between tenure track faculty and non-tenure track faculty. But we're actually all in the union together, and many of us who are, tenure track faculty who are fairly well paid, normally people might not find common ground with a lowly paid, non-tenure track faculty member. But here we've been working extremely close together. We have each other's interests, and it's been amazingly rewarding to do that. I should point out the university didn't like that concept. And we originally formed a union that had tenure track and non-tenure track in one union. And they took us to court for a year and a half to prevent us from doing that. And they actually won. So we had to form two separate unions. And yet, from our point of view, we're one union. So at first, the university, and they paid millions of taxpayer dollars to force us to form two unions. Now, when we have our meetings at the bargaining table, originally they started having separate meetings. Now the meetings are almost identical. So the same people go to all the meetings. So it was just an attempt to union bust and to sow division, where we have quite the opposite. We have solidarity.
Let me read from an article you co-wrote in Jacobin Magazine online, jacobinmag.com. The article begins, quote, "On February 18th, the tenure track and non-tenure track faculty who make up the University of Illinois Chicago Faculty Union UICUF Local 6456 will walk out of the classroom and onto the picket line for a two-day strike." Tell me a little bit about some of the particular tactics here. Why is it just a two-day strike? Did you want to make it longer or shorter, or why settle on 2 days?
Well, first of all, we don't want to go on strike at all. I mean, our job is in the classroom. Our interests are with the students. We don't want to hurt the students, and we don't want to stop the flow of knowledge. You know, professors hate when they have to miss a class. I mean, students may like it once or twice, but professors hate it because you have a syllabus, you've got to do all your work in order, and this throws a wrench in it. So we're being forced to do this, and we're being forced by the complete intransigence of the administration. Just parenthetically, we spent 24 hours last week at the bargaining table, and of the 24 hours, the administration was present at the table for 1 hour. For all the other time, they would leave, they had to caucus, who knows what they were doing. But my colleague, Walter Ben Michaels, who co-wrote the article with me, said, how long does it take to sit around and say no? But so we are forced into this. Our decision to do a two-day walkout rather than an extended strike was because we don't want to create a situation. We want to give the administration a chance. So we're going to walk out for 2 days. We're going to show them what it looks like to have your faculty on strike. We believe we'll have a very strong turnout. We believe that this will affect the way that the taxpayers see the administration. And then we'll go back to work, and we will go back to negotiating. If they continue the foot-dragging, the outrageous foot dragging, you know, and they're not sending their top people to the table. They have their lackeys and they're who are paid, by the way, also with taxpayer money. We all volunteer our time, so you get the distinction. But we're going to go back and we're going to negotiate. If they still are foot dragging, then we're going to go on a full strike. I mean, next time, no more Mr. Nice Guy, you know. And that's going to happen toward the end of the semester, and it will create a lot of havoc. So what we're saying to the administration is, take a look at this and imagine this going on for an unspecified amount of time.
Do you feel like there has been now this kind of dovetails a little bit with regards to the kind of privatization and a trend of what's been called neoliberalism among basically the entire society, involving the rights of capital and of powerful interests over the general population and of institutions like a public university. And yet you're seeing now, and I think this strike might be emblematic of a kind of pushback among people who are just, to borrow the famous line from the movie Network, mad as hell and are not going to take it anymore. And you're finding now that you're seeing maybe a resurgence of protest activity. Do you think that this is emblematic of a larger trend, perhaps in the general society, perhaps among colleges and universities?
Well, that is a good question, and I should point out that we at UIC are the first, what we call kind of research one or top tier research university. I think we're not the only, but we're one of the very few since the 1960s when public employees unionized without any problems, by the way. I think this is a pushback, and the university is resisting so hard because not only do they want to prevent us from doing it, but they really also want to prevent Champaign-Urbana from unionizing. And we're in the midst of unionizing Champaign-Urbana, and they really want to show that what you would say neoliberal policies, the university really wants to show that neoliberal policies should win out, that professors should not consider themselves workers. They should consider themselves professionals and part of the whole sort of neoliberal establishment, when in fact we're workers like anybody else. But I do think that there is a movement, and you know we're working with the AFL, with the American Federation of Teachers, and with the Illinois Federation of Teachers, as well as the American AAUP, the American Association of University Professors. That's our union, and they are moving out to other places. So I think there is especially in areas like the universities, there's an awareness of what neoliberal policies are, and there is definitely a desire to push back. I mean, just in social media today, looking at now that we've kind of been utilizing Facebook and Twitter, the message is really going around and resonating. And someone wrote to me from the city university system and said, you know, we've been told we can't go on strike. How can we do it? How are you doing this? So, I mean, I think there could be a kind of academic brush fire that could be catching on. People, I think that's one of the reasons they're also pushing back so hard against us, is that they don't want to set the policy. The university is a corporation run by management, and you're telling us that you think it should be run by the workers? You know, I mean, that's really the kind of absolute message, or the implicit message that's not being said overtly, but is there.
Talk to me about some of the possibilities of the ranges of successes here. Part of me thinks that the university is probably not going to, although I might be wrong and would be happy to be proved wrong, it would seem to me that management at UIC would be not willing or not able to accede to the demands of the strike, even if the strike might be deemed as successful. Absent that, what do you think would be a success here? Would it be just raising awareness among the larger community, helping to raise awareness among UIC students and staff? What do you think?
Well, I guess I would. I think that all of the things that you just said about raising awareness, and by the way, the students at UIC, the ones that that I see and know, are supportive of the strike. I mean, for them, the people they deal with, the people they respect, the people they learn from are the faculty. They don't know. The administration is just this shadowy, organization that has no contact with them, except maybe periodically to tell them, you have to pay this amount of money to us or we'll kick you out. But I think that awareness raising is great. And by the way, I mean, I should just also mention parenthetically that Hull House, which is on the UIC campus, and, you know, Jane Addams was this great social reformer in the 19th century and was very involved in the Pullman strike in the 19th century that really rocked Chicago. Anyway, Hull House is supporting us, and you'll be seeing a big banner across Hull House that says Hull House supports this strike. So, I mean, the point is that that level of awareness, that level of education is always good. However, respectfully disagree with you, I think we're going to win. In every labor struggle is a negotiation. You won't win 100%, but I think we're going to get a lot of what we are asking for. This is our first contract. This is not our last contract. So, you know, it's important that the first contract be a good one, but we're going to be renegotiating this contract every 2 or 3 years, 3 or 4 years, 3 or 4 or 5 years, depending on what kind of contract we come up with. But so I think that whatever happens, it's going to make a difference, and it's going to be much better than what we had before, which is essentially no power at all and no say in our own work lives.
We've been speaking with Leonard Davis. He is a professor of English at the University of Illinois Chicago, talking to us about, as we are recording, an impending strike at UIC and the issues related to that. Leonard Davis, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Leonard Davis, recorded on February 15th, 2014. We're coming to you from the trenches.
NATO!
We are!
NATO!
We are!
Protests come and they won't go
home.
NATO! I say 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 NATO! Protests come and they won't go home. Heads of state come to visit Rome.
Protests come and they won't go home.
Stack my sandbag to the summit gun.
Protests come and they won't go home.
Come, Mr. President, President Obama.
Protests come and they won't go home.
No need to tell the world that you killed Osama.
Protests come and they won't go home.
It's 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot fence.
Protests come and they won't go home.
It's 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot fence.
Protests come and they won't go home.
The NATO Three are a group of three activists who were arrested during the 2012 NATO summit in Chicago. The NATO Three were charged with terrorist activity, among other crimes, and went on trial in January and February 2014. Chicago anti-war activists have responded that the NATO Three have been the victims of police entrapment, incited by two undercover police officers whose superiors admitted they colluded with federal authorities to fabricate the case against the NATO Three. The NATO Three case was the focus of a recent call-in program on Chicago's CAN-TV, Cable Channel 21, hosted by activist Andy Thayer. We'll now listen to the audio of the program, which featured special guest and national security journalist Kevin Gostola, who contributes to the website Fire Dog Lake. The following program was recorded on Friday, January 31st, 2014, just before the NATO 3 trial was slated to conclude.
Kevin is going to be discussing the so-called NATO 3 trial that's ongoing down at 26th and Cal. And for those in our audience who are not familiar with the case, this is a case that was developed by the Cook County State's Attorney's Office in the run-up to the May 2012 NATO conference here in Chicago. People may remember that there was all sorts of hysteria in the press about terrorism and anarchists and all sorts of scary headlines and journalists asking breathless questions of protest organizers about, is the Black Bloc coming? Are anarchists coming? And so forth. And what turned out was, frankly, a farce, that you had the arrests of five young activists, three of them from Florida, who are currently on trial at 26th and Cal. And as you saw the headline of today's show, it really is a farce. It's a show trial that the Cook County State's Attorney's Office is going on. Kevin is with Fire Dog Lake. He has been covering the trial from the start. He was here during the NATO conference as well, covering the protests. Kevin, as someone who's been to the trial every single day, who experienced the protests and so forth, what is going on at 26 in Cal? What should people in our audience know about what's going down there?
Well, it is truly a spectacle. In fact, they call the public that attends every day spectators. So that shows you what sort of tone they're setting already. And when you sit there, you have these two undercover officers now that have been brought in.
Mm-hmm.
We know their names. They're Officer Nadia Chico and then Officer Mehmet Egan, who was known as Mo. And they both somehow, I think from the widespread surveillance operation that was being conducted in the months before the NATO meeting, they were sent in to go after these three young men.
And these are three activists who came up from Florida. And one of the striking things about the testimony that we've heard so far is that you had these undercover Chicago police officers who were plying, for example, a young man 20 years old, underage, with alcohol, getting to say all sorts of silly things on tape. The man is an alcoholic, and he's underage, and I think you don't want to put a microphone in front of a drunken Cubs or a White Sox fan, let alone a 20-year-old with an alcohol problem, and then treat it as serious evidence of a plot to commit a crime. And that's the caliber of the investigation that we've got.
It seems like also this person, Brian Jacob Church, who they think is like the ringleader of this plot, it sounds like he had substance abuse issues too. One of his cohorts said he was hitting the cough syrup too much.
And you had right on tape there, this is undercover police tape, the undercover officers giving the defendants beer and so forth, and basically getting them to say a lot of silly things. But at the same time, you had the officers themselves making comments, trying to spur on the alleged terror activities when the three activists didn't seem to be doing much to get things done. Tell us a little bit about that.
All right, so you have Mo saying things like, "I'll make some." And he's talking about the Molotov cocktails, the so-called Molotov cocktails, which are really four beer bottles. And we don't know how much gasoline was in these bottles because the police actually dumped the contents of the bottles into the toilet in the apartment where the men were staying.
They destroyed evidence, in other words.
Yeah, but also the evidence was later marked a biohazard, so you're putting that in the sewage system. I don't know how people feel about that in the city here of Chicago. But also, these men were told by Nadia things like...
Nadia being one of the undercover officers.
Right. We're told things like, I'll go down with you to Obama's headquarters if you want. You know, I'd be happy to go for the ride. Mo said things like, I've got $2. We could go to the gas station. Brent Betterly, one of the NATO three, said something to the effect of the proper way to make Molotovs is with gasoline. So these men were always focusing people.
So the undercover officers were basically directing them, coaching them in how to produce these implements of the alleged a plot against the Obama campaign headquarters was going to be carried out with a slingshot, I believe.
Something like that. And they were very terrified. I guess one of the people, Church, was going to shoot a bow and arrow at Rahm Emanuel's house. I don't know how
with
that would be.
With a note on it.
With a note on it.
Yes.
Because he doesn't like public officials. And so that makes him a terrorist because he doesn't like public officials.
Well, we do have a caller on the air, and this caller, you're on CAN TV. What's your question or comment?
My concern is, how we allowing police to gather, mm-hmm. keep, and store information and mm-hmm. have these different types of files on citizens. And I thought that issue was dealt with a long time ago and how this information mm-hmm. they gather, especially when they're dealing in terms of evidence, how this evidence is not really being scrutinized, you know, how it's not mm-hmm. really being examined. And then we had the state's attorney almost in the bed with the police, and it's not a separation of how you want to put it, power departments and all that, like they're all in bed together. Mm-hmm. And then when you have a situation, we have a defendant, you really don't have like a one-on-one. You got three or four people that's against. You got the police department. You have the state's attorney along with the judge and da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just wonder what happened to certain laws that are supposed to protect us.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, caller. And actually, the very practices that the police department employed in this circumstance were banned under a suit that came out of the late 1960s, the so-called Red Squad. These sort of practices were banned. Unfortunately, during the late Daley administration years, that consent decree was whittled down and basically made to be meaningless. But we've got to remember, this is a Chicago Police Department that not only gave us people like John Burge, who systematically tortured African-American suspects into giving false confessions. It's also the Chicago Police Department that spied on the Black Panthers and murdered the Black Panthers. This is a Chicago Police Department that's got a long history of this sort of stuff.
Exactly. What they're talking about, though, is about, you know, the national special security event, taking advantage of it. That you have to know that the meeting that was held here in May 2012 was designated this national special security event. And so when you think about this in terms of the whole country, what they do is they come into the city and they expand all these surveillance apparatuses. We have new cameras on our streets because the meeting came to town, and they were just taking advantage of the event to send these police officers into the activist communities.
And we also have the infamous sit-down, shut-up ordinances, which basically made it much more difficult and legally perilous for people to organize protests. That was rolled out in advance of the NATO summit, and that's something that you've seen in city after city where these sort of things happen. The authorities use these special national security events to clamp down on protests. We now know that there was a systemic nationwide campaign to shut down Occupy, which our own Rahm Emanuel participated in with the Obama administration, orchestrating these seemingly separate acts in cities around the country, as it turns out now, thanks to a civil rights law office out of D.C. We now know that thanks to the documents that they were able to obtain under subpoena power, that this was a systemic campaign. We do have another caller. Yes, caller, you're on CAN TV. What's your question or comment, please?
Yeah, good evening, Mr. Thayer. This is one of the instances where I have to agree with you. This to me strikes me so much mm-hmm. as entrapment. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a good, that's not a good way for the police to be using their resources. You know, obviously these kids were young, and you know, at that age, you're going to let off steam and you're going to say things, but did they really have the capability of following through? And again, mm-hmm. they, you know, when you entrap somebody, that it's kind of like playing dirty pool. It's mm-hmm. not something, as you said, by law that they should have been doing. Those officers could have been working the streets, doing something better. I don't think these kids could get off scot-free, some type of probation or some, you know, even some kind of hard community mm-hmm. service to make them, to let them know that you really do have to be mindful of that. I wouldn't let them go scot-free, but I wouldn't mm-hmm. put them in jail either. But I'd make them do something where they were doing some physical work, you know, get some work out of them, make them so maybe they'll stop and think twice in the future before they get involved in anything kind of revolutionary, because you walk a fine line. You know, neither side And this can come away squeaky clean, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. But again, I would side with you that it's entrapment, and I hope the judges have enough wisdom to see it as such and take into consideration these kids' age and be lenient with them, because again, I don't think they had anything really bad in their past history and that. But I mean, they need to learn a little lesson, but not too okay. tough. Like I say, would they have even followed through? I mean, everybody has said stuff at that age that mm-hmm. they probably regret saying, and if you know, but entrapment is entrapment, and I hope they, you know, I hope they get off. Thank you.
Well, caller, I think you raise by implication a number of important points here. The fact is that the Cook County State's Attorney's Office decide to hit these kids with a sledgehammer of charges rather than saying, well, maybe, you know, conspiracy to commit petty vandalism. I mean, these are crimes of a much lesser import, but instead they made a political case out of it. And I think this is the most important fact of this trial. Why is it that the Cook County State's Attorney's Office under Anita Alvarez, and why was it that Gary McCarthy of the CPD decided to totally go hog wild on these kids that no serious person, and columnist after columnist has noticed, no serious person would consider them a terrorist threat. And I think you have to say there was a political agenda at work here. You're spending millions of dollars on this NATO summit. At the same time, you're shutting off half the city's mental health clinics, and that was just the opening wave of cuts by this mayor. You have to justify this hype about security. And you, of course, agents have their own career ambitions, but why did Gary McCarthy, why did Anita Alvarez go along with this, Kevin?
I think they're going along with this because they were invested in exactly what you're saying. I think that this is self-perpetuating. Mm-hmm. I see this as being a case wholly fabricated out of suspicionless surveillance. You know, and it's very topical in this country right now. I'm a national reporter. I've covered National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden. I dropped what I was doing covering that, and I'm now invested in covering this case. Mm-hmm. But I think it's incredible that I see that all these officers in the police intelligence unit went out to cafes, punk rock shows, public meetings, gatherings.
They couldn't find anything.
They found nothing. And the other thing I'd add for the caller is that these young men have been in jail for almost a year and a half. Right. So when we're talking about what sort of lesson they might be taught, I just would make sure that people consider the context of the punishment already, that in fact their lives have been disrupted.
Much of it in solitary confinement and jail abuse that people on the NATO 3 Defense Committee can tell you much more about it. I know that we've got probably callers waiting to get on the air, but we do need to do a few announcements here midway in our show here. First of all, I'd like people to get involved in the Gay Liberation Network. We are an LGBT rights organization, though we do see it as important to have solidarity with all justice causes. Please check us out at our website there, gayliberation.net. And we have our meeting the first Monday, first Wednesday of each month. Our next one's going to be next Wednesday at the Burger Park Cultural Center, 7 p.m., first Wednesday of each month. And then finally, if you want to follow Kevin's dispatches from the courtroom and so forth, go to dissenter.firedoglake.org, and you can see his information there. Lots of articles, not just about the NATO 3 trial, but also important topics such as his on-the-scenes coverage of the Chelsea Manning trial and many others, Edward Snowden, you name it. We've got a situation where this trial is, I gather the prosecution's going to be resting its case sometime next week. You've got journalists, not just you, but quote-unquote mainstream journals, who basically see this case is a sick joke, And you also have the U.S. Attorney's Office that wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. Why is that so?
We're going to learn. We're going to learn when the defense gets to put on its case exactly why the Secret Service, you know, the Secret Service said they couldn't substantiate the threat to Obama's headquarters. That's pretty significant. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to find out exactly why they didn't want to touch this.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also, we got another caller here, and we'll pick up more of this conversation. Caller, you're on Candy.
One of the things that we used to have years ago as a release valve,
mm-hmm.
let the police do something wrong, or let the judges do something wrong, like a judge or a prosecutor. We used to be able to sue, but now mm-hmm. there's so many different roadblocks, and you got to go through so many procedures in order to sue a city or the police department. I'll give you an example right now. Chicago has mm-hmm. somewhere in the neighborhood at least $200 million in pending lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And even though the police could be wrong left or right, as a matter of fact, they have been on videotape, you mm-hmm. know, hurting somebody. And there's so many different laws to stop you from suing them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, and that's one of the biggest problems with, for example, the problems faced by the Burge victims is that you have these prosecutors who basically make their careers off of these young black men, and they are all black men, which says something about the state of race in this city.
You've been listening to a call-in program featuring host Andy Thayer and journalist Kevin Gastola on a program about the NATO 3 recorded on January 31, 2014. To learn more about the NATO 3, go online to the website of the NATO 3 Defense Committee online at freethenato3.wordpress.com with a numeral 3 in Free the NATO 3. An update on February 7, 2014, the NATO 3 were found not guilty on terrorism charges, but were found guilty on incendiary device possession charges and mob action charges, charges that carry a maximum 30 years in prison. Sentencing against the NATO 3 is scheduled for Friday, February 28, 2014. We're coming to you from the trenches.
All we ever get is a veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations that obscure reality.
We have an update on that.
Good evening. We have a lot of news to tell you about.
Giant media corporations decide what is news and what is not news.
Is it to control people's ideas? Is it to control their imagination?
The news we rely on is in the hands of commercial enterprises.
If it didn't appear in the New York Times,
Fox News,
CNN, it never happened.
There are certain events in journalism that you may not cover.
There were incidences of physical abuse.
CBS decided this is not a story we're going to fight for.
All of a sudden, the plane exploded. And one guy goes, oh, you think it's a missile?
It was a complete act of deceit.
Well, we basically supported the Bush policy.
When that many people die, you owe it to them to find out what really happened.
Spying. Censorship.
Militarism. Secrets. Corruption.
Power. Lies. Profit.
Profit. Profit. This is the mother of all scandals.
Corporations are making profit off the killing.
You cannot go against the White House and survive.
There has never been a conspiracy.
Wars really are started by the mainstream media.
That's the audio from the trailer of a new documentary film about the media entitled Shadows of Liberty. Indeed, there has been a lot of recent talk of developments connected with the media, including a proposed buyout of Time Warner Cable by Comcast, and a court ruling striking down the FCC policy of network neutrality. To get some additional answers to some questions, we'll conclude this episode with portions of a question and answer session with Chicago Indy Media's Mitchell Stepinchik at a panel presentation in Oak Park, Illinois on October 27, 2013. The question is, how much control does billionaire media mogul Rupert Murdoch hold?
And the answer is not as much as it used to. You might have heard about the what's been called Hackergate, a scandal that's emerged in the last couple of years, where it turns out that, in quick background for folks who might be unfamiliar or might need a refresher, 2011 news had broken of a scandal that's actually a reprisal of a previous scandal where Murdoch connected newspapers in Britain were actually caught hacking into the voicemails of various celebrities and various members of the royal family and also everyday citizens. In fact, by the number of someone estimated in the thousands. The scandal enveloped practically all of Britain for the better part of a half of a year. It actually stymied one buyout of that. And in order to try to shunt off the developments of that scandal, what had been News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch's main media monopoly, is one of maybe five or six companies. The number keeps shifting. It's probably maybe as little as seven. Companies that own the majority of newspapers, majority of media that people see, hear, and read in the United States. But Murdoch wound up splitting the company in two. In fact, the deal was completed earlier this summer, where you have New Corporation and Old Corporation. New Corporation is actually now known by the name 21st Century Fox. And the idea is to basically put the profitable arm on that. Maybe three quarters of the profit of that had been coming out of News Corporation had been through new media, television, internet, movies for the most part, and cable television. So all of that would go under the rubric of 21st Century Fox. The old media, mostly newspapers, print, like HarperCollins Publishers, the book publisher, that's owned by News Corporation. That stuff, which is also, it so happens, not only less profitable, but also more connected with the scandal, the Hackergate scandal that had been continuing and actually still continues. There's actually three ongoing investigations in the United States now about the impacts about this. What he did might be violating federal law in the United States. That's another lecture. But that, it wound up being not only less profitable, but also more prone to this scandal that could bring the whole thing down. And so they decided, okay, we'll split the company up. Rupert Murdoch sits as the chair of both companies, but they are, for all intents and purposes, otherwise two separate companies. So we've actually seen a little bit of this deconcentration about that. Where before Rupert Murdoch and News Corporation, that's now the new News Corporation. The News Corporation ranked maybe like fifth or sixth as far as among the top 10. Time Warner was first. Comcast, especially now with its buyout of NBC Universal, was second. And then their numbers basically shift depending on the year, depending on the media. Murdoch was in News Corporation, Fox, and so forth. We're in that mix, fifth or sixth, depending on the year you see it. It's considerable, and it's actually gone down. We've seen a little bit of a deconcentration on that score.
The question is Al Jazeera America available in Chicago, and how available is it across America?
That's probably less than would it be otherwise. That is a good question. I have to admit, offhand, I'm not sure. It is growing. It is now, I think, available in Chicago. Someone correct me on this?
Yeah.
No?
Yes. That's my question.
Yeah. Time Warner, which is the second largest cable provider in the United States, and they provide cable for, the monopoly cable provider for both Los Angeles and New York. Not Chicago, it turns out. That's Comcast. But it turns out that Time Warner blanket said, no deal. We're not going with Al Jazeera America supposedly under any circumstances. They're now, at least I've heard in talks, that might not materialize. The footprint of that, of the channel is certainly more than I think the three cable channels that Al Jazeera English had been. Because it turns out that Al Jazeera, the original Arab channel, had a spin-off English language channel that was also broadcast out of Qatar, but basically, for all intents and purposes, a British news operation. But available in the United States, cable companies were offered it. All but three individual cable providers turned it down in the entire United States of maybe like 3,000 firms. Al Jazeera America bought the what had been Current TV in order to try to get a foothold in that. But once that was announced, Time Warner said no deal. So it's basically whatever the footprint of current TV had been, and that's maybe 20 million households, I think is the number on that, is now Al Jazeera English, except for what had been in the footprint of Time Warner. I'll call it maybe 15 million households, I think. I'm open to correction on this. If someone wants to do the homework assignment, you're open to please do and correct me. But that's where I think it is. That amounts to maybe, just one last point on this, maybe a tenth of all TV viewers in the United States, which is certainly larger, but, you know, it's they've got a reputation to try to overcome if they want to try to get that. Unfortunately, they are overcoming it in directions I find are rather discouraging by actually trying to go with the rather propagandistic model about, yeah, we'll basically repeat whatever the Pentagon says and go along with the usual pablum of, no journalism, repeat sources verbatim, not do any kind of critical investigation. Even though that's the kind of thing you would expect a name like Al Jazeera to do, they're apparently not going to do that or de-emphasize it considerably in order to try to get that footprint into the United States. That seems to be the direction they might be going into. So even though there might be hope there that, yes, we finally have Al Jazeera in the United States, but they're muting their message down.
The question is, what do you think about government whistleblowers?
Whistleblowers. Yes, please. In fact, I mean, that is maybe the best hope we have regarding not just, I mean, the most famous one, especially since in early June. Mm-hmm. With the Edward Snowden revelations, former NSA sysadmin, systems administrator, who basically said, yeah, I've got access to unparalleled information, but it's showing a scary thing, and I have to show that, and he went public. And yeah, it has changed the game considerably, and that is a great hope. And we can see examples of that going up through that, and not just him. There have been other NSA whistleblowers who have not had his success. William Binney, it turns out, is a mathematician with the NSA. He's been going public, I think, for the last, like, almost decade. He had worked there for a long time and then went public, and he was actually cited in, out of all things, a New York Times video produced by Laura Poitras. She's the now German filmmaker who worked with Glenn Greenwald to record the videos of Edward Snowden. It turns out she was hired by the New York Times to make a documentary, 8 minutes long, you can see it on the New York Times website, about an NSA in-progress what's called a server farm, a gigantic technical installation in the middle of the desert in Utah whose idea is to harvest everything. In fact, it's got a name, Stellar Wind. That's their project to basically harvest the entirety of American and probably international communications and store it all in these massive facilities in Utah. And the film, about 8 minutes long, interviews William Binney, a whistleblower, who then talks about some of the details of what he knows. And they actually go to the in-progress facility about this. There's an entire rich history about this. Whistleblowers are particularly powerful because they expose the secrets that powerful interests want hidden. The more exposure about that, the better. Especially since a lot of the exposure of those facts have a very sordid side to them. And it's very understandable to see. And that's why they have such great power and why they are persecuted relentlessly.
That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved, including helping to make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Indie Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org. I'm Rita Sand. Special thanks to John Groot and the staff of Chicago's Can TV for their assistance. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode From the Trenches.